The most passionate advocates for evolution, such as Richard Dawkins, Lawrence Krauss, and Sam Harris, paint humans as mere byproducts of thousands of generations of thoughtless adaptation, one species among multitudes, insignificant without any true control over our baser instincts. Kenneth Miller rejects the notion that every human thought and action is predetermined. He argues that while natural selection explains the shaping of our bodies and brains, it is not a social or cultural theory of everything. In his new book, The Human Instinct, Miller argues that a proper understanding of evolution reveals a unique humankind, with one foot planted amongst all the creatures we evolved alongside, and the other in the special place of self-awareness and understanding that we alone occupy in the universe. Kenneth Miller is a professor of biology at Brown University and the author of such books as Only a Theory and Finding Darwin's God. The new book is The Human Instinct, and we welcome Kenneth Miller to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
What brought you to this particular subject and ultimately to look at instinct?
Well, I've been a vocal advocate and defender of evolution, especially the teaching of evolution in the public schools, for quite a long time. I'm a co-author of probably the most widely used high school biology book in the country. I've debated so-called scientific creationists and intelligent design advocates, and I've even testified in two very highly publicized federal trials on the issue of teaching evolution in our schools. And the textbooks in particular brought me into defending our treatment of evolution in many school districts and schools around the country, in part because as a biologist, I recognize evolution as the central organizing principle of biology, and therefore it's sort of the hallmark of our textbook, and that makes it a target for various anti-evolution groups and individuals around the country. An awful lot of that opposition, of course, comes from what people regard as the religious implications of evolution. But in recent years, I think it's also become very clear that an awful lot of people find evolution, if not objectionable, sort of distasteful, sort of depressing, in part because of the way some of the theory's own advocates describe it. And those descriptions are take the form of saying, well, you know, we human beings aren't special. We're just one species among many. We're not really significant in the scheme of things. And then they go further. And they say that evolution has so shaped the human mind and our own conceptions that our artistic tastes, our ethical judgments, even our freedom of action, none of those are real. Evolutionary natural selection has shaped human social interactions. It guides our thoughts. And it even has shaped a sense of right and wrong, so that right and wrong are not authentic things. There's no such thing really as good and evil. It's just the social interactions and mores that have been shaped by evolution. And I find, and I have found, that whole take on the meaning of evolution for our species to be, first of all, mistaken in terms of what it assumes about the science, and secondly, profoundly off-putting for an awful lot of people who find what they regard and what they're presented with in terms of the message of evolution to be some kind of bad and depressing news that they'd rather not hear. I think, based on an authentic understanding of what evolution really tells us about human nature, that none of that really follows from the science. And what evolution does is not to minimize the human creature, but rather to sort of confirm the very, very special position that we hold in the world of life in a way that basically assigns to our species an enormous degree of responsibility for what's happening now on planet Earth and especially for the future of the planet.
So as the subtitle says, how we evolved to have reason, consciousness, and free will. Talk about the overlapping nature of those three, of reason, consciousness, and free will, how they're similar in an evolutionary sense as well as separate and different.
Sure. Well, there are schools of thought that say that we don't have any of those things. that consciousness is an illusion, that human reason is faulty because we do reasoning with the human brain, which is an evolved organ, and that we lack free will because even our thoughts are profoundly determined, not just by our evolutionary ancestry, but by the physical conditions and the movements of molecules and atoms within our nervous system. In fact, if we have any of those things, true consciousness and true free will, we have it because evolution gave them to us. And the reason, as you know, if you've looked at the book, I have a chapter on free will. I have a chapter on the nature of the human brain, the nature of the human mind, and a chapter on consciousness. All of these things mark the human creature, I think, as unique. We are animals, to be sure, but we are not just animals. And I can take free will as a very important example in this. Free will doesn't mean that we are not affected by the conditions around us, by our schooling, by our upbringing, by our interactions with other individuals. Of course we are. But what free will suggests is that we can take all these things into account and make free and independent judgments based on what we see in the world around us. Now, I am sort of an advocate for free will, not because of any religious convictions, even though I am in fact a person of faith, but rather because I think science itself depends upon the existence of free will. The entire scientific enterprise is predicated on the notion that we human beings can conduct experiments, we can make observations, we can look at conditions in the world around us, and we can come to rational conclusions on the basis of evidence. If we truly lack free will, then we really can't be sure that those conclusions are in fact free and independent and based on the evidence. Because if they are strictly determined by physical conditions, we have no reason to believe them to be true. No less a scientist than Stephen Hawking, the late Stephen Hawking, of course, when he was musing about his hopes to have a final theory, a theory of everything, recognized that if we humans lack the free will to make scientific judgments, then the physical nature of that theory would actually determine whether or not we would arrive at it. And then, as Hawking realized, we would have no reason for knowing whether that final theory was true or not. So I think basically the case I tried to make for all three of these human qualities was basically a case of respect for human individuality, respect for our own ability to reason and to make judgments, and basically respect for the idea that we can act as free and independent agents because all of the scientific enterprise depends upon that.
So you make this very clear in the book, free will and consciousness are not threatened by evolution, but they are its products.
Yes, exactly right. And I will confess to the fact that in my chapter on free will, even though I tried to make a case for it, neither I nor anybody else can show convincingly exactly how the human brain generates these free and independent decisions. The brain is an incredibly complex organ that you might say so far has failed to figure itself out. But the interesting thing is even people who are determinists, who are critics of free will, would argue that evolution gave us a sense that we have free will. And some have even argued that that was its adaptive value, that having a feeling that we make free and independent decisions was part of the socially cohesive glue that enabled human societies to form. So the interesting insight from that I tried to put forward is if the illusion of free will helped the human species to survive, then that illusion was basically a prophecy that became self-fulfilling. And again, the case I tried to make is that evolution is not the enemy of consciousness or free will, but basically it's the source of it, if indeed we have it.
Do you believe that these schools of thought will always be a fight?
Well, I'm not sure fight is really the right word here. I'd say contentious, and I'd certainly go with that. Anyone who works within science, anyone who knows anything about the scientific enterprise, realizes that science can be pretty contentious. And if you go to a scientific meeting, not only will you hear and see people presenting data, the results of experiments, and so forth, but you're going to see people arguing. And some of the most, you know, passionate arguments I've ever seen have been at scientific meetings. And I remember, I'm a cell biologist by training, and I remember 10 or 15 years ago seeing an incredibly passionate argument at a platform presentation that actually spilled over to the bar afterwards as to whether, when the chromosomes move apart and a cell divides, are the chromosomes being pulled or are they being pushed? That seems like a pretty basic question to answer, and I think we have the answer now. But science itself is contentious. And I think what we should make of ourselves as a result of the insight that we are evolved creatures, that we were produced by the process of evolution, I think that's always going to be a contentious field. And the way in which I've tried to wade into that controversy or those discussions is simply to make a case for the authenticity of human values and beliefs and human reason that basically would stand up against those who would use evolution to basically cut the human creature down and basically say that we're not significant to the universe and we really don't matter in the grand scheme of things.
So when it comes to the human instinct, what do you want our takeaway to be?
Well, the takeaway that I would strive for is basically, I would say, inspired by people who have come before me, and the one scientist from whom I draw the greatest inspiration, not just because he was such an effective spokesman for science, but also because I think he had an appropriate understanding of the significance of human life, was the late Carl Sagan. Sagan was very fond of saying that we human beings are made of stardust. And what he meant by that is that the heavier elements, everything beyond helium and hydrogen, the heavier elements, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, are actually formed in the fires of stars. That's where the elements that make up the human body come from. So he would say that we are literally made of stardust. In a material sense, we are part of the cosmos, as Sagan put it. But significantly, we are the part of the cosmos that has become not only alive, but aware and reflective. And Sagan would look at human life on this small planet and would say, on Earth, in the person of the species Homo sapiens, the cosmos has begun to wake up and take the measure of itself. And we human beings, we are the cosmos waking up and seeking to understand itself. And frankly, that's exactly the message that I'd like people to take away from the book.
The name of the book is The Human Instinct, How We Evolved to Have Reason, Consciousness, and Free Will. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Kenneth Miller, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you for sharing with us this morning.
The pleasure was mine. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, The Human Instinct, How We Evolved to Have Reason, Consciousness, and Free Will. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.